WGN, I've heard so many times people say hearts and prayers, best wishes for the families in California. And I know when we all say that, we mean it because we mean it and there's nothing else we think we can do. And then there are people like Christiana Trapani, who is the owner of Door County Candle Company. And she thinks, well, I can not only wish the best for those people, but I can find a way to raise money for them. It's her specialty. And she joins us again on WGN. Christiana, welcome back. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me today.
Still making and selling candles in Door County, Wisconsin?
We are. We are making and selling candles, and we continue to raise funds and raise awareness, which is our mission.
And do you always dedicate your business to a particular charity, or are there sometimes lapses? You know, Ukraine is maybe off the radar for some people, and the fires hadn't happened yet, or are you always raising money for some cause?
We are always raising money for some cause. Last year, we donated over $40,000 to various causes, such as like Make-A-Wish and different causes. And then when there's a natural disaster such as the California wildfires, we dedicate a candle with our Support a Cause line to a very specific cause.
So tell me about this candle for the folks out in California.
So we created this candle on the 9th. So as fast as we could, we pulled an all-nighter getting it together. We used an orange clove scent of ours. We named it the Golden State. And we are dedicating and giving 100% of the profits from this candle to the Red Cross for wildfire relief. So since the 9th, we have been able to raise $12,000 and counting, which is incredible.
People buy the candle, and you say the profits go to relief. Do they keep the candle, or do they send the candle to somebody?
You know, a lot of people do a lot of both. We've had a lot of candle orders going to California. We've had a lot of candles people are buying for others and buying for themselves. But a lot of the orders we are shipping right now are going to California, actually.
So it's the American Red Cross, which is probably providing a whole host of services out there, huh?
Exactly. We're sending it to the Red Cross specifically for wildfire relief, and exactly, providing a lot of different services, helping with, gosh, you name it. But they are they're doing a lot to help, and that was the nonprofit we definitely wanted to help with this candle.
$29.95 for the candle.
Yes, $29.95, and it's an orange scent, and yeah, all the profits are being donated.
I think when I first talked to you, it might have been Ukraine. Are you still doing a flag for the a candle for the people in Ukraine?
Yes, we still have our Ukrainian candle. As you kind of said, it's not as much on people's radars, but we were able last year to still raise an additional $18,000 for Razum for Ukraine, which is the nonprofit we're supporting with that candle.
How many people are in your business? It's still a pretty small shop up there in Door County, right?
Yes, it is small. We only have 8 employees. So it's not a lot, but we have a handful of volunteers, such as my mom, my husband, and a lot of other people in the community help us out. So those are our volunteers also, which make it possible.
I suppose, and hear me out when I say this, because I think I know your heart, and you're just so smart to find a way to funnel money to these worthwhile causes. So hooray for you. But maybe if I go there to buy the $29 candle for the folks in California, I'll now be on your website and I'll go. There's a Christmas candle on sale, or there's another candle I might want. So it gets people to the site, and that's good for you too, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, it's funny because someone asked during Ukraine, are you just doing this for, that? And I said, honestly, like, never even thought about, our products. I always, I'm focusing on the disaster. Like, when we launched a Ukraine candle, we did not make our own products for about a month and a half, and our shelves were empty. And we finally realized, okay, we need to get back to also making our own products. So we definitely were humbled by the fact that people are buying other candles, of course. But we love being able to post those updates of how much money is being raised. It's really keeps us going every day.
Yeah, and $40,000 for a relatively small operation like yours is a very big check last year, and I applaud that. What's the number one selling candle that you have there?
Our number one selling candle was probably our Door County Cherry Candle. If you take away the support of causes like Golden and Ukraine, probably our cherry people feel very nostalgic when they smell that scent. So that's a very popular one of ours.
Door County Candle Company is in Door County, and the website is DoorCountyCandle.com. DoorCountyCandle.com. Let's support a smart business, and let's support a good cause. Christiana, good luck to you. Thanks for giving us some of your time.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Bree Fowler is back, the senior writer over at CNET. Hi, Bree.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. TikTok, the clock is ticking on TikTok. What's going to happen between now and Sunday?
You know, at this point, it's anyone's guess. Everything is super fluid right now. We haven't gotten a Supreme Court ruling yet. TikTok hasn't sold, and they're not saying what they plan to do between now and then.
A ban is supposed to go in effect in the United States. People should not be able to use TikTok pending something happening starting Sunday night, right?
It kind of depends. One of the rumors floating around is that TikTok will go dark, that they will shut the app down, that it'll redirect people to a website explaining what happened. But also, you know, they could just let it be. And if you're an existing TikTok user, the app will still be there. But eventually it's going to get buggy and it's not going to get the software fixes and upgrades that you normally would. And it's going to die a slow death. So we're not sure right now.
Who gets to decide?
TikTok is not talking.
Who gets to decide? Does the incoming president get to decide, or is this Congress that needs to change?
Well, right now we haven't had a change in administration yet. So the ban technically kicks in the day before that happens. So maybe TikTok will go dark for a day and then come back. I don't know where this ranks on incoming President Trump's list of priorities. He has a bunch of stuff that he says he plans to do on day one. So it's unclear where this is on the grocery list for him.
Is it the sort of thing, though, that Donald Trump, with an executive order, could order it operational if it does go dark?
Well, you know, actually, the Supreme Court actually asked that question during the oral arguments on Friday, if Trump could issue some kind of statement of non-enforcement, that he could potentially direct the Department of Justice to not enforce this law without, you know, repealing it or anything like that. But, you know, if you're a tech company like Apple or Google or, you know, someone that carries the TikTok website, you're kind of taking a risk that you could be prosecuted.
So this would require congressional action, it sounds like, a bill to repeal the previous law.
You could, or you could also, and this is what's been floated, have another bill or an amendment to the law that's out there now that would extend the sale deadline. Because right now, the current law does provide for an extension potentially if certain conditions are met. Now, whether they've met those conditions remains to be seen. A bill was floated yesterday in the Senate. It was abruptly shut down, though, by Senate Republicans.
Is there a suitor out there? Is somebody poised to buy it?
Well, there's a lot of rumors, but we have had investment groups come forward saying that they're interested in buying. I mean, TikTok is a moneymaker. Like, there's definitely a way for a U.S. company to buy it and turn it. I mean, it's a great business now, if you're looking at it that way. And they could make some serious money. The problem is that ByteDance has said they don't want to sell, and that it's not a question of how many dollars. So, you know, we're kind of stuck in this game of chicken now as to who's going to bend first.
One last thing about this. Is there another company coming along? I mean, it was Snapchat, or it was Twitter, it was Facebook, mm-hmm. or it was MySpace, if you go back. I wonder, is there the new shiny object in the app world that people are going to be gravitating to? And this wobbling of TikTok creates an opportunity. Do you see the next big thing?
Oh, sure. I mean, in tech, there is always someone ready to come in and fill the void. And it could be existing companies. I mean, you think about Instagram Reels and YouTube Shorts. I mean, those are already out there, and a lot of TikTok creators already post on those platforms. But there are other applications out there, too, that could work. And ironically, one of them is a Chinese app called Red Note that people have been signing up for in very large numbers over the last couple days. Although it seems to be that they're doing it mainly out of spite towards the U.S. government in signing up for another Chinese app. It looks just like TikTok, but the problem is that it's completely in Mandarin. So you have to use Google Translate to do everything. And that makes it a bit, you know, a little awkward to use. And if you're a small business or a creator looking to make money, maybe this isn't the best route for you. But, you know, there's always new apps and always new tech and existing stuff out there, too. And the creators will go where the eyeballs go. You know, they need that. They need traffic. And, you know, something will definitely pop up.
So you're not going to create something for an app or a site that doesn't have many users. You know, when Elon Musk bought Twitter, a lot of people said, that's it, I'm out. And plenty of people did cancel or delete their accounts. But X is still strong, isn't it?
Yeah, it's still, you know, it's unclear because it's not a public company and we don't get numbers. And you know, Elon Musk will make statements about traffic and things like that and ads. And there's really no way to verify any of that or do year-over-year comparisons if you're, you know, a business person or a potential investor. So, you know, you got to take all of that with a grain of salt. TikTok, I mean, we're talking about it just going away in the U.S. versus, you know, people leaving. So it's a little bit different.
And that would be really extraordinary, wouldn't it? I mean, this isn't just some company. It's an immensely popular company. I remember earlier this year or late last year seeing commercials from, you know, from ByteDance or TikTok, but it demonstrated how people are using it. You know, a couple of cattle farmers talking about how they put up videos and teach people about where their food comes from, and that's TikTok. This is a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, and TikTok, I mean, this was all part of their public relations campaign after, you know, people started talking about a ban, and this started percolating in Congress. This was to get people to push their representatives to vote against it. And it didn't work because this was a bill that was, for better or worse, passed by, you know, a large margin in both parties.
Yeah.
But TikTok has 170 million active U.S. users, which when you think about the fact that there's only 335 million people in America.
That's half.
Yeah, I mean, that's huge.
That's amazing.
And, you know, to start that from scratch would be tough. But if you already have existing, you know, online infrastructure, you could probably grab that and make some money.
Talk to me about Joe Biden and an executive order of his own on cybersecurity.
Yeah, we've been seeing a ton of, you know, regulatory moves and executive orders and all of this, you know, end of term kind of thing. It's do or die to get stuff out there. So the president has issued an executive order today, and it's aimed at strengthening the nation's cybersecurity. And it's designed to make it easier to go after foreign adversaries or hacking groups that might compromise U.S. internet and telecom systems. And, you know, it also sets minimum cybersecurity standards for government technology contractors and, you know, makes it sure, requires them to submit evidence that they're meeting those standards. So, you know, it's one of those things, hopefully the next administration will follow through on. It's a pretty bipartisan issue, but, you know, it also is regulation, and the incoming administration is not very big on government regulation.
What about the CHIPS Act or the idea that we're going to make it more difficult to export chips?
Well, this goes to cybersecurity and security in general, too. They want to put tighter controls on the export of chips that are used for artificial intelligence. And it's about economic security, national security, but also, you know, preserving the economic interests of U.S. companies that make these chips. The tech industry and chip companies are not necessarily super happy about this. And there are issues, too, because, you know, while there have been regulations over, you know, selling these kinds of chips to adversarial states like China and Russia, this adds 120 countries to the list where there would be export restrictions. And we're talking about countries like Switzerland and Portugal and Israel. So it definitely broadens that quite a bit.
I think that's going to be a new horizon in security and conversation with you and me and the whole world, isn't it? I mean, it's not fighter jets, it's chips, it's technology. And if you send it to maybe a third party ally, that doesn't mean that eventually it won't end up in the hands of an enemy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, supply chain, you know, it applies to chips and tech too. And, you know, a lot of it is, it's not necessarily anyone's intentionally doing anything bad, but, you know, chips get put into lots of things and you don't necessarily know where they all end up.
Bree Fowler over at CNET, CNET.com. She's a senior writer there and a friend of ours. Thanks for your help today, Bree.
Happy to be with you.
Michael Miller, as I just mentioned, is a longtime guest on WGN, and he joins us again. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me back, John. It's great to talk to you.
Nice little laundry list of topics for you and me today. I see you are looking about the effectiveness of dollars spent on pre-K education. I don't know how the new administration feels about that, but what do we know about the value of putting money in those programs?
You know, the research on this has been going on a long time because we've been trying to figure out what's the best way to use money to encourage education and encourage it early on. Head Start is a prime example, and a lot of the research on Head Start was not very promising. It had great effects while the children were in there, and as soon as they left, by the time we got to fourth or fifth grade, the effects were completely gone because I guess there was no reinforcement. But a couple of economists up in the New England area decided to look at a program where we would get involved dollars in pre-K, which would, in a sense, bring the children in and get them educated very early on, and wanted to see what was the effect on two things, on the family in terms of incomes and on the children themselves. Was there a long-term positive consequence? And the results were mixed. They found, for example, that because the children were at the pre-K, the parents could work longer, and the average increase in income of the earnings of the parents was 21.7%, and it 6 years out, it was still there. The incomes went up substantially, and the reason was because they worked about 10 or 12 hours more per week than they would have otherwise. So what we see here is that by having pre-K, the income of the household was definitely positively affected. But of course, the whole idea of pre-K is to have an effect upon the child more so than the family and the family finances. And unfortunately, when they looked at how did the children do going out 6 or 7 years, they found there was essentially no impact at all on test scores or their academic progression. Or their attendance, anywhere from kindergarten all the way to eighth grade. There was no long-term positive consequence of the money. And that's sad because you think the ultimate goal then is, of course, to assist the child. But this is one case where the intentions are pure and the money is substantial and there were some positive effects, but unfortunately not for the child.
I want another study.
Yeah, it just doesn't sound right, does it?
But well, it's certainly counterintuitive, particularly since we know that around second grade, you need to have instilled an appreciation of reading and an enjoyment of school.
Exactly.
And if they're fifth or eighth grade and they're still broke, it's hard to fix them. I don't like the way I just put that, but it's so much harder to learn.
It is. And I'm not an expert in education, per se, even though I've taught for 45 years. But we do know that one of the important things with children is reinforcement. So reading to a child for a year and a half can have very, very expansive effects upon, say, their vocabulary and so forth. But if you then stop, and that's kind of what Head Start did. Head Start got the students involved. And then when the program, when they aged out of it and the program was over, there was very little reinforcement. And
yeah.
That's why most of the data shows by fourth grade, you couldn't tell who was or who was not in Head Start.
That's remarkable. I wonder why we have that academic fall off. And I suspect it's because the kids we're talking about come from families that aren't academically inclined. I mean, at a basic level, the parents aren't reinforcing it. Would that be your guess?
That is my guess, that it's not being done in the household, because you want to believe that it's being certainly done in school.
Do you?
Learning is almost like a full-time thing where the family has to be involved.
Yeah, right. So do you think then that's money poorly spent?
You know, that's a tough call, because certainly maybe the physical situation for the child will be better with the higher earnings. They will have less trouble meeting bills. There'll be less stress in the household. They might be able to buy a better food or better clothing because of this 21% increase in their earnings. So there could be other aspects of the child's life that are improved by this program. So we can't say that the money is poorly spent, because there's no doubt that the increase in that the money spent led to an increase in value within the household. It's just, it was not educational. It was otherwise, like these things like say food or clothing and paying for the rent and so forth.
You also saw some research or have some thoughts about health care coverage and Medicare. Do you want to start on that? What's your big picture here?
Yeah, again, here's another case of good intentions. And one thing we're trying to do, of course, is lower the cost of medical care. And Medicare, because of its size, and I'm being of that age, I'm now on Medicare. What happens is Medicare can throw around its weight by simply saying, well, I'm not going to pay this much. I'm going to pay less. And the question is, if Medicare pays less, does that affect what happens in the market of the people who receive, smaller amounts of money? So, for example, when I was working full-time at DePaul, I had a great healthcare program. I could go to any doctor I wanted. The moment I was on what is called Medicare Advantage, which I'm on now, certain doctors, which I used in the past, simply will not see me. And that is because Medicare will not give them as many dollars for the same procedure as they had gotten before. So what happened is that Medicare lowered the price they were going to be willing to pay for various durable medical equipment. And what these economists wanted to know, well, if they give less money to these firms that provide this equipment, is there any reaction in the firm? And the unfortunate thing was, just because Medicare wants to lower the cost doesn't mean that we repeal the laws of economics.
Yeah.
So since there was less money involved, the firms took it out, in a sense, by going and getting involved in much less research and development in their industry. The research and development expenditures of affected firms fell 53% because of this lowering of the price. And there was a 44% decline in revenue. So you can see why the firms, they have, if they're going to get 44% less revenue because of what Medicare did, they've got to make some kind of cutbacks somewhere. And one place you do it is, but then why go and develop new stuff or better stuff if I know I'm not going to get any money for what it is I've paid? And so the net effect was quite negative. And it's not surprising. If you give me less, I have less incentive to do something. I'm simply not going to do it.
Right. I suppose the next question is the solution to that then Medicare increasing the pay? And I wonder, too, how you feel about that Medicare Advantage plan decision that you made. Michael, are you happy with that overall? I mean, it maybe costs you less, but you just highlighted one of the disadvantages of those Advantage plans. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN. Here's more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The Chicago Reader faces an imminent risk of closure. The Reader Institute for Community Journalism, which runs the paper, has announced staff layoffs and the resignation of its CEO. The weekly publication says the urgent need to cut costs is aimed at avoiding organizational closure. It says a combination of financial losses, operational challenges, and external pressures are to blame. The Reader has increased donor outreach and crowdfunding campaigns. It's also trying to secure advance payments for partnerships and advertising. The Reader was founded in 1971. One of New York City's most popular pizza restaurants is opening a location in Chicago. Cranes reports Prince Street Pizza is opening in Fulton Market at 939 West Randolph. Prince Street Pizza is named after the address of its original location in Manhattan and serves Sicilian and Neapolitan-style pizzas. Its kitchen in Chicago will have a water filtration system that matches the pH level of tap water in New York, which the owners say is important for authentic dough. The new local spot will feature a Chicago-specific pizza with sausage, green peppers, and jardinera. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Business of Food Time. Now, here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. There was a huge announcement yesterday from the Food and Drug Administration.
Well, the FDA has finally banned red dye number 3 from food.
That's Scott Faber with the Environmental Working Group, a non-governmental food safety organization.
Consumers will finally no longer have to worry that a chemical linked to cancer is in food, especially food that's marketed to our kids.
And he says the banning of red dye number 3 is huge because it's found everywhere.
Red dye number 3 is a chemical that's from refined petroleum products that's designed to make our foods bright red, like candy canes and cereal, frostings, cookies, many products you might not normally think of.
What's surprising about the banning of red 3 is that it took so long. More about that after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. Back to Scott Faber at the Environmental Working Group talking about the FDA's ban on cancer-causing red dye number 3 being used in our food.
This is a chemical that's already been banned from cosmetics. If it's not safe enough to put on your body, it's certainly not safe enough to put in your body.
When was it banned from cosmetics?
1990. Citing the link to cancer. And at the time said, we really ought to consider whether it's safe to be used in food.
This would seem like a no-brainer. Has anybody been lobbying against the banning of Red 3?
Yeah, unfortunately, some parts of the food industry have been fighting to preserve the use of Red 3. Even though there are other ingredients that can make food red, that can make candy red, it's been banned in many countries that still have red foods and still enjoy red foods. So we just don't need a chemical linked to cancer. And it's good news that FDA is following the science and not simply bowing to industry.
Manufacturers using Red 3 in food have until January 15th of 2027 to get it out of their systems. On the food calendar, it's National Fig Newton Day. I don't think there's any red in Fig Newtons, is there? I'm Steve Alexander. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
We're talking to economist Michael Miller. He joins us on the Wintrust Business Lunch from Western Washington University. Previously, he taught over at DePaul. By the way, Michael, just personal aside here, you mentioned you're in a Medicare Advantage plan, and you're a little frustrated that maybe you don't get all the doctors you want. Are you satisfied overall with that investment, or do you wish you had stayed with traditional Medicare?
No, I'm perfectly fine with it. The what you have is the way it works out. After all those years at DePaul, I received from them this health care benefit. So that's the Medicare Advantage. Medicare pays 80%, DePaul pays the 15%, and then I'm on the hook for the rest. But the base pay that the doctor receives is what would be a Medicare expense. And I had two cases of skin cancer. And I had this doctor who removed it right before I fully retired, and she was dynamite. Oh, my gosh, I'd recommend her to anyone. And when the second one was developed, the same dermatologist, she said, you can't go to that person because she won't take Medicare. Now, the nice thing is I found another doctor who out here who was just not quite as competent, but just as competent overall. And so I've been a very lucky man that way. I do have very good health care coverage in this part of Washington state. Hmm. But it does limit. In other words, there are certain doctors I have to watch, and if they're not in my network, either I have to pay out of pocket or I can't see them. And it's even worse, by the way, for people, lower income people who are in Medicare, because I mean, Medicaid. Medicaid even pays less, and therefore many doctors will not see Medicaid patients. And therefore, the group of doctors any Medicaid patient can see is greatly reduced.
Before the break, you were talking about the fact that since Medicare is big enough to lower the costs, and we all think that's a good idea, the perhaps unintended consequences, then companies that provide hardware for people medically inclined, they do less R&D. The products aren't being developed and improved. And so I wonder if that's a trade that we ought to accept, or do you prescribe a solution to that? What are we to do? Because I think
I'm not sure there is. You know, we face the same thing when it comes to medicine. And what happens here is that the rest of the world does what Medicare does. They say, well, simply not pay as much for these medicines as the medical companies have developed, you know, what they want to charge. But they have to earn back their investment. So what happens, since the prices are not controlled in the U.S., you and I in the U.S. pay a much higher price than, you know, I live literally 9 miles away from the Canadian border. They pay less 10 miles away from me than I do. The whole point, though, is that I'm subsidizing. The fact that I'm paying more subsidizes the fact that Canada could pay less because they simply refuse. And one thing we could do is the companies could simply say, well, we're not going to sell it to you at that price. This is the price you're going to have to pay. And what will happen is that the price in say, Canada or Germany or wherever will rise, and the price here could go down a little bit. But they also have to recognize, if we purposefully lower the price of a medicine, just like with this equipment, that there is less incentive then for people to do this innovation, and therefore it won't affect me because of my age, but, you know, people, my children and so forth. 25 years from now, you'll hope that there will be these brand new drugs that will allow them to have much better lives. Those drugs may never be developed.
Well, let me ask you this.
Not enough of,
let me ask you this, Michael. We're short of time, and we're not even getting to all the smart topics you brought up, but do you have an informed opinion about our healthcare system and the payment program that we have versus the rest of the world? I think a lot of us are inclined to say that we're not doing it right. What do you think?
In my opinion, I think it's a misunderstanding people have of healthcare. To allocate a scarce resource, you either have to allocate through quantity or you have to allocate through price. In the United States, we do it through price. So people who are better off, like you and me, we can pretty much have the health care that we want because we can afford or are given at our jobs health insurance. In the rest of the world, just like, again, across the border in Canada, when I got that skin cancer, I would have to wait in line. I wouldn't have to pay nearly as much as I paid here. But I would have to wait in line, and that line, of course, could be very, very long. So one thing I do see is a whole bunch of Canadians come down into Bellingham area, which is so close to the border, because they can't get their coverage up there in a timely manner. So I know we have our problems, but when you look at the outcomes that we have in the U.S., I think Americans are receiving, I think, the best health care in the world. There could be some changes that we, you know, more
many
Americans.
Many Americans are receiving the best
health
care
not
in
all.
The world.
You're correct.
Many Americans also are watching everybody else get it, and they don't.
Yeah, but you know, there's no one who can't get it because we do have what we could call them county hospitals or whatever. A hospital can turn no one down. If you come in with a broken leg, you must be treated, even if you have no money. That wasn't the case in the old days, and it is now, and that's the way it should be.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the other countries, again, you wait if you have to wait in line, there's a chance that you will suffer while you're waiting, and then it could get much worse by the time you see the doctor, and therefore, overall, the outcome is worse, not better, when you allocate through quantity, where everybody waits in line, as opposed to paying.
Michael Miller is an economics professor at Western Washington University, not too far from the Canadian border, former professor emeritus at DePaul. Let's pick up on some of these other topics next time. Nice to talk to you today, Mike.
It was great talking to you, John. Take care.
Stay well.